This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Craig Finn is the frontman for the band The Hold Steady. When he was 12, he bought Let It Be. No, not the Beatles album. It was a punk album by The Replacements, and it contained what was soon to be Craig Finn's favorite song of all time.
Putting the needle down and hearing the first song, I Will Dare, is that... It was, you know, shambling and romantic. And I mean, the whole album stands out to me, just how drunken and obnoxious and belligerent they could be, but then just really vulnerable and sensitive, too.
It's Bullseye. This week on the show, Craig Finn of The Hold Steady talks about the unpredictable and emotional music of the punk band The Replacements and how one of their songs changed his life. Documentarian Errol Morris reveals why he won't play gotcha with his interview subjects.
To me, the name of the game is to discovering something about other people, how they imagine themselves, how they describe their own experiences.
No, I'm not going to lie to you. I mostly want to talk to him about a series of beer commercials he directed.
I sometimes think my movies will be completely forgotten, but what will survive, ultimately, is my Miller High Life commercials.
And I'll talk to the actor Benedict Cumberbatch. He's playing villains in two big upcoming blockbusters. I'll talk to him about putting his spin on one of pop culture's most ubiquitous heroes, Sherlock Holmes. All that and more coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. Every week on Bullseye, we're joined by our favorite critics to recommend bits and pieces of culture that are worth your time. This week, we're joined by weblink maestro Jason Kottke from Kottke.org. Hey, Jason.
Hey, Jesse. How you doing?
I'm excited to talk about your all-time picks here for internet. First of all, this is the most amazing thing that the internet has to offer, as far as I'm concerned. Information on the topic of sending children through the mail. I couldn't even make it through saying it. How do you even find out about sending children through the mail, Jason?
I saw a picture. It's a photo from 1900, and it's a mail carrier posing with a young boy in his delivery bag. And it's from the Smithsonian. It was on Flickr Commons, which is a program that Flickr has where museums and other public institutions can upload their photo collections, which is fantastic. It's like there's stuff from Smithsonian and NASA, the National Archives, Brooklyn Museum, all sorts of different stuff.
Okay, so was sending children through the mail ever an actual thing?
Apparently so. The post office introduced their parcel post service in 1913, which is like basically you can send stuff that's bigger than a letter through the mail. And this was a great thing for people in the U.S. who were living in rural areas because they could get all sorts of stuff shipped to them for the first time, like live animals and stuff. Like live animals that didn't need feeding in transit were fine to ship. And so I think people thought, like, well, you know, if I can send like chickens through the mail, like, why can't I send kids through the mail?
There's so many reasons.
Well, and yeah, so according to the Smithsonian, there were a couple of kids that were sent by mail before the Postmaster General put his foot down and stopped it.
Okay, let's talk about one of the great internet phenomena, which is arguing over a weird theoretical physics question. And your post about Cecil Adams of The Straight Dope, the famous question-answering alternative newspaper column, trying to answer the question, an airplane taxis in one direction on a moving conveyor belt going the opposite direction at the same speed. Can the plane take off? Now, what did you learn when you delved, I'm sure, far too deep into this question about something that will never happen?
I learned that a lot of people think it will take off, and that there are other people who will swear up and down, even people who have, you know, who have, you know, physics degrees, science, knowledge, background, you know, they insist that the plane will not be able to take off.
Do you think this is a worthy Kickstarter project?
Well, it's funny because Mythbusters, a few years ago, they aired a program on this question. They had a truck pulling a tarp, basically, that was, I don't know, it was a couple thousand feet long. And then they had an ultralight take off. You know, basically, they had the truck pull the tarp one way and the ultralight was going the other way.
An ultralight, that's like a one of those super skinny airplanes.
Yeah, it's like a one-seater. It's an ultra-light airplane. It's a very light airplane, I guess. You know, they had the plane try to take off, which, of course, it did.
Wow. Physics is amazing, and so is the internet.
It is.
Jason Kotke's post about whether a plane can take off if it's going exactly the same speed forward as a conveyor belt that it's standing on top of is going backwards is on his website at Kotke.org, as well as his post about sending children through the mail. You can find links to both on the Bullseye page on our site, MaximumFun.org. Jason Kotke from Kotke.org, thanks for joining us.
All right, thank you, Jesse.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. The Guinness Book of World Records says that Sherlock Holmes is the most represented fictional character in film and television history. More than six dozen men have plopped a deerstalker cap onto their heads, put a pipe between their teeth, and stepped in front of a camera to solve some mysteries. But my guest, Benedict Cumberbatch, is more than just the latest to take part in a proud and tweedy tradition. His Holmes is a different breed. He's the star of Sherlock, the BBC One series that's captivated the UK with 10 million viewers an episode. It moves Holmes and Watson into the present day. No more deerstalker, no more tweed. The royal scandals involve internet dominatrices, not opera singers, but Holmes' brilliant mind and impatience for everyone else on Earth besides Sherlock Holmes remain. Here's Cumberbatch as Holmes from the show's first series, demonstrating his detective powers at a crime scene.
Victim is in her late 30s, professional person going by her clothes and guessing something in the media, going by the frankly alarming shade of pink. Travelled from Cardiff today, intending to stay in London for one night. It's obvious from the size of her suitcase.
Suitcase?
Suitcase, yes. She's been married for at least 10 years, but not happily. She's had a string of lovers, but none of them knew she was married.
Oh, for God's sake, if you're just making this up...
Her wedding ring, 10 years old at least. The rest of her jewellery has been regularly cleaned, but not her wedding ring. State of her marriage, right there. The inside of the ring is shinier than the outside. That means it's regularly removed. The only polishing it gets is when she works it off her finger. It's not for work. Look at her nails. She doesn't work with her hands. So what, or rather, who does she remove her rings for? Clearly not one lover. She'd never sustain the fiction of being single over that amount of time, so more likely a string of them. Simple.
It's brilliant.
Both seasons of Sherlock are available on DVD and now can be streamed online via Netflix and Amazon Instant. When he's not solving crimes, Cumberbatch has made time for roles in War Horse and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, among others. And he has some high-profile film roles on the horizon. He'll voice Smaug the Dragon in an upcoming installment of the Hobbit films. And he'll be the bad guy, or as he puts it, or is allowed to put it, the not-so-good guy in the upcoming movie Star Trek Into Darkness. Benedict Cumberbatch and I spoke last year. We started off talking about the Star Trek movie. It's stuff that didn't make the cut when we first ran this interview. Back then, the movie was a really long way from release. Benedict Cumberbatch, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be on the show.
I had a friend who worked on the first Star Trek movie.
Mm.
As I want to say, she was an apprentice assistant director. Assistant directors are the people on a set who are sort of in charge of comings and goings and you know...
She wasn't called Rachel, was she?
No, she wasn't.
Or isn't, even. She probably doesn't needed to change her name just because she did that job.
But the thing that I remember most from her telling me about that job was that they were shooting a significant portion of it on the studio lot, but they had constructed special secret tunnels so that people in makeup who, as various aliens from Star Trek, couldn't be seen because if someone saw that it was like a Klingon or a...
they'd know what to expect.
Then they would know what kind of alien was in there.
Yeah. They do a good job. I think they do a good job of building up expectation. I think JJ and Bad Robot in general have got this fantastic niche in an otherwise overly saturated, transparent market of look what's coming, it's coming, here it's coming. And by the time it's coming, you're kind of bored already. You know, he creates mystique and a different type of energy of expectation, which is quite rare in this modern age of, you know, over spoiling trailers and lots more chocolates than you can possibly eat before your appetite needs them. And I think the anticipation is such that when you get what you get, especially when it's as high quality as his productions are, you have a real thrill because it's genuinely something you didn't know about. And I play along with the secrecy game. I think it's fantastic. And it's a good thing for the audience in the end, although all of us, including me, just want to see the film. I mean, of course, we're eager to. But until that happens, why talk or see pictures or have any other reasons to spoil what should be a treat?
I'll tell you what I need to hear to get excited about this new Star Trek movie.
What's that?
Cumberbatch.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you very much. Well, it's an amazing family to join, and I love the first film to death. I mean, I saw it sort of begrudgingly. I've never been a massive Star Trek fan. I only say begrudgingly because it's not something I'd necessarily rush out to see, but I was so enthralled by it. I mean, I was in tears in the first 5 minutes and laughing the next 10, and it's a great roller coaster ride. And I thought they all did, and I got a real tingle of satisfaction at seeing them all come together. And I kind of became a fan, really, of the series through that. And so when I got the call very late in the day by film casting standards, I was over the moon. I couldn't wait to try and help out.
Your parents have been working actors for pretty much all of your life.
Yes.
But neither of them has ever been a major star. So I imagine that you've gotten to see that, especially as a kid, you got to see sort of some of the fruits of what it's like to be a working actor, which is to say that, you know, when you've got a gig, especially in film or television, it pays well. It's a great job. It's very fulfilling. But also that, you know, someone else has to sign off on you working. And it has to happen, you know, every 3 months if you're working on film and television often. And that if no one is casting you, then you are not working for money.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that was like for you as a kid. And if the idea of acting seemed cool and glamorous to you, or it seemed like a bummer.
Both at times, I think. I mean, a mixture, and that's the way it is. It was a, you know, I didn't walk into this with any need for a reality check or preconceptions as to it all being, you know, a glittering ascendancy to the stars. It's just kind of really honestly about hard grind, faith in the people you work with, and hopefully the people that are trying to get you the work, and some certain professional courtesy. And I know this sounds obvious. I often get criticized by fans for being obvious in interviews, but, you know, sod it. If you've not been an actor before, you need to hear this sometimes. And I think Mum and Dad were wonderful at giving me every opportunity to do anything but be an actor, to avoid the peripatetic nature, to be completely beholden to your career rather than your lifestyle or your family choices or any other kind of form of shaping your life. Your one and sole aim was to be around and available for work and try and get it in order to pay the bills.
I think that everyone who works as an actor realizes very quickly when they start auditioning for especially screen work that just the way they are in the world has a certain way that it reads to people on screen in half a second, and that they will be cast based on that, irrespective of their talent. And you are so distinctive, like you're exceptionally handsome in a very unusual way. And
you sound like my mom.
But I mean, genuinely, I mean that absolutely sincerely. That must have driven your career in a way that you might not have expected when you're, you know, auditioning for theater roles, and it has to do with your ability and talent, and you think you can transform yourself in the way that you can when you're on stage for 3 hours, but can't when you're on screen for 3 minutes.
It's wonderful when people take risks with you, and that's what I'm about. And I've been lucky to, I'm quite ready to accept the fact that if I shift from the small screen to the big screen here in the way that it's been going, that there will be a few fluttering through the letterbox where they'll be driven, slightly sociopathic, highly intelligent, bordering on Asperger's, fast talking, cerebral characters to cater to. And I'm a small fish in a very big pond now, so I'm happy to play to my strengths to begin with. But I think, like all of us, we just need a bit of variety in our lives, and I think audiences do too. And I just get more of a kick, I guess, out of having a sort of more diverse smorgasbord of choice and appearance and challenge with each role.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Benedict Cumberbatch. He plays bad guy John Harrison in the upcoming film Star Trek Into Darkness, and he voices the villainous dragon Smaug in an upcoming installment of the Hobbit trilogy. But his breakthrough role was that of a hero, Sherlock Holmes. The BBC One series Sherlock is a modern take on the most famous of all fictional detectives. Let's talk about Sherlock.
Yeah.
Sherlock Holmes, depending on your definition of fictional character, I think that God, Jesus, and Santa Claus appear in more films and television shows than Sherlock Holmes. But
only just.
Yeah, Sherlock Holmes has been in hundreds of films and television programs, portrayed by dozens of actors. And when you audition for this role, you're running up against not just, you know, Basil Rathbone or whatever, but this accumulation of cruft of hundreds of people, and ideas of hundreds of people. Mm. How can you, when you get the sides for an audition for a part like that, how can you do anything that's not just a pastiche of your ideas of what this guy is? How do you find something that's actual in that?
That's a good question. Well, what did I do? I saw the strengths of their script. I saw what they were wanting to bring to life. But yeah, you're entering a pantheon of what, 70 plus actors have already trodden in the footsteps of that role. But you can't. You just disassociate with all that. It's a little bit like going for any audition. You walk into the room and you forget the fact that you've just left a waiting room with five other people who are equally, if not better, suited for the part than you. And you think, I'm the only person they're seeing today, and that's all that matters is what happens now. Because you can't take on that baggage. You know, any level of performance and craft in the performing arts is about being present in a moment. And I think while there are some massive technical things to master with Holmes, feats of memory and line learning, which I always struggle with, and the physical technicalities of hitting a mark, speaking at that pace, and the alacrity of his movement, and as well as his intellect, you know, all of that requires a certain amount of technical skill. But you still, the best takes, the ones that work, are the ones where that just happens, and it's there, and it's a given, and something fresh occurs. Christ, I mean, we had a bit of a blank canvas with this one. It's 21st century, after all, and while Holmes is a modern man and was, you know, up to his eyeballs in cutting edge science and the burgeoning technology of criminal pathology in his original state, you know.
He's always pouring one beaker into another beaker.
Well, you know, that's a bit of that going on, exactly. But, you know, my point is that, you know, there's, you know, he's somebody who there's a lot to draw parallels with in modern life from the original, as there is obviously having him in modern life. There's a lot that I can use that's modern that's going to make it feel as if it is a fresh take on Holmes. And also, I think what they thought I'd lend to it, which is true because of the way I look and I have a high neck and, you know, done stuff in period costumes before, is that, you know, I've got a slightly old world, old soul, otherworldly quality, which sort of marries that junction between someone who is Victorian, who we are honouring as a Victorian hero, even though he's playing with an iPhone and surfing the net and, you know, performing a million sort of social and modern media functions in the blink of an eye. I guess that was it, really. I guess that was it. It was just going in with confidence, the confidence that that character required and the script and the updating of it required.
After a break, more with the actor Benedict Cumberbatch from PBS Masterpieces, Sherlock. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Have a favorite Bullseye segment? It's easy to share it with your friends. You can find links to our page on SoundCloud at MaximumFun.org. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Benedict Cumberbatch. He plays bad guy John Harrison in the upcoming film Star Trek Into Darkness, and he voices the villainous dragon Smaug in an upcoming installment of the Hobbit trilogy. But his breakthrough role was that of a hero, Sherlock Holmes. The BBC One series Sherlock is a modern take on the most famous of all fictional detectives. Benedict Cumberbatch and I spoke last year. In this clip from the series' first episode, Sherlock Holmes impresses his new companion, Dr. John Watson, played by Martin Freeman, by telling him everything he's picked up about him in the short time since they've met.
When I met you for the first time yesterday, I said Afghanistan or Iraq. You looked surprised.
Yes, how did you know?
I didn't know, I saw. Your haircut, the way you hold yourself, says military. But your conversation as you entered the room...
A bit different from my day.
...said trained at Bart, so army doctor, obvious. Your face is tanned. But no tan above the wrists. You've been abroad, but not sunbathing. Your lips are really bad when you walk, but you don't ask for a chair when you stand like you've forgotten about it. So it's at least partly psychosomatic. That says the original circumstances of the injury were traumatic. Wounded in action, then. Wounded in action, suntan, Afghanistan, or Iraq.
One of the things that I found the most compelling about the relationship between Watson and Holmes is... That Watson, as portrayed by Martin Freeman, is a veteran. He's an army doctor, as in the stories.
Yeah,
and he's struggling with post-traumatic stress disorder, or post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Yeah,
and you know, PTSD is something that can cause tremendous difficulties in relating to others. That's one of the greatest challenges that people with PTSD suffer from. And it's very vivid for me because I grew up in a family with a father who was disabled by service related PTSD. And watching these two characters who each in their own way are struggling to find a way to relate to each other and to the world. Mm. It's kind of moving, isn't it?
I mean, it's kind of moving, and it's in a way, you know, jokes aside about what the sexuality or implied sexuality of either of them. I mean, Christ, John's a ladies' man, and he's asexual until he meets Irene Adler, and then something switches on in him, which he thought he had control over. But I agree with, I think, what you were pointing out, which is that they are two men trying to find a context in society, and both have one through something imposed, I guess, by the trauma of being in the theatre of war, and the other self-imposed, have these elements that make them both outsiders. So they find a community with each other and a source of strength from each other. And that's very touching to me. And I think, you know, I spoke to a lot of people, well, two or three people, particularly at an awards ceremony, GQ Awards this year, who were so grateful to Martin's performance and portrayal of Watson, because, you know, while it's great fun and it's distracting and it's good fun telly for them to watch, they felt that something was being represented. Now, of course, with his character, it's not a disability through an IED. It's not a trauma that's marked him physically. He has a sort of sociopathic, so a psychosomatic associated wound, which, you know, Sherlock gets very, very early on, as not being to do with his leg, but something else. What his problem is that he, in a sort of Travis Bickle vein, I guess, can't re-assimilate with society because he actually misses the thrill of the theatre of war. And that's a very dark and awkward and difficult thing to confess to, which I guess is why it's sort of surfaces as nightmares and the limp, because you're suppressing a desire to go back into combat for the thrill of being that adrenalized by knowing your life is held in the balance by a thread, and you know, and your colleagues around you and your entire situation is constantly insecure. I mean, that's quite something to admit to actually enjoying. And I think it's sort of shameful in a way to some people. But, you know, it's born out of service and dignity and honor and being a good soldier, which are all qualities that should be anything but shameful.
I want to ask you a sort of a personal question.
Sure.
And you can answer this to the extent that you feel comfortable.
Sure.
Quite a while ago, you were carjacked and abducted.
Yeah.
In South Africa while shooting an entirely different project. This was in 2004,
right.
I believe.
Yeah.
And you know, the trauma associated with that, I can only presume must have been tremendous. And I wonder how going through that experience affected your life.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's one element where I can empathize with Sherlock's impatience. I think it made me for a while, that was the hardest thing for anyone around me to deal with, was that I yearned for a life less ordinary with every second I had to breathe, because I came face to face with some very plain facts. One is that you die on your own. No matter who you're with or who you're leaving behind, you have to face death on your own. And also the fact that I was too young to die made me angry to live, if that makes any kind of a sense. So I had a sort of profound insight, really, and a fantastic dinner party anecdote at the hands of these people who, you know, it could have been a lot worse. I could have been left with scars, physical and emotionally, that could have been a lot worse. I wasn't beaten up. I was pushed around a bit, but and tied up and put in the boot of a car as well as the side of the road. But and had a gun put to my head. But I wasn't pistol whipped. I wasn't beaten with a stick. I wasn't kicked. I wasn't raped. I wasn't cut. You know, there was an awful lot that didn't happen that I can be thankful for, because ultimately it was a small event in a very big country. And the next day there was a newspaper headline to give perspective and immediately rationalize what had happened to us and give a context for how this is something to be got over rather than be traumatized by. It was a very, very big event in my life, but it's one that I've learned from rather than being traumatized from. I went to see a counselor the minute after it happened. We had that on offer, and one of the actors I was with didn't, and the other actress did. And I think it was harder for them. And I'm not going to speak for them on this program, but I think, you know, the main way it changed me was it made me, in the immediate aftermath was that I cried the first time I felt the sun on my face the next day. You know, there were a lot of sort of almost born again, resurrected feelings, this thing of the preciousness and wonderful and beauty that is life. I mean, it's just such a blessing. And I know it sounds a bit soppy, but when you've come near death, you really, really, really learn to reevaluate it and appreciate it. And that's a great thing to get in your 20s, because you start, you know, using your vivacity not to kick against the idea of, oh, I'm immortal, there's no such thing as mortality, but to embrace your mortality and take control of it. So I went off and skydove, and I swam with sharks, and I did lots of kind of crazy adrenaline fueled stuff. But I also traveled on my own for a month afterwards around Namibia and Cape Town, and sat in my feelings, pondered it, dwelled on it, moved around in it, dismissed it, came back to it. You know, it's always there, and I'm fine talking about it. It's a f-ing exhausting anecdote. I'm not going to excuse my swearing there, because it's a really big story to go into.
Seems reasonable.
It is in this instance. I think you can bleep me out on that, and I think people might understand. It's a big story, and it's a wonderful one to tell. But I do kind of feel a bit pale and worn after going through it. But it's not something. I don't know. I've had near-death experiences since then, and that's obviously been the most acute one, I should say. I would say rather. But I've got nothing other than good out of it, really. I think the positive drive you get out of wanting to live a life less ordinary has borne fruit. I think I quelled the other things in me that sort of knocked my equilibrium or calm about a bit. I've kind of dealt with a lot of those. So, I mean, it happened not for a reason, because I don't think these things do. It just, I was in that place at that time. But it was an extraordinary, extraordinary thing. And it's definitely shaped part of who I am.
Were you able to find a way to find equilibrium again? I mean,
I had the job for a start, so I had to focus on a very different reality and set of circumstances to my own. And that was a massive, as it is in an actor's life, it's a massive headspace to occupy. And then to settle the equilibrium, it took time. Of course it took time. I struggled with it and with the other two actors. And, you know, you go through, well, I don't know that you in general go through, one goes through in general, but I certainly went through the thing of, wow, I need inoculating. I need to just be knocked out. I'll, drink a lot of whiskey and take a sleeping pill. Then I got ill because I came off the sleeping pill, and then that day passed, and then I was completely fine again. I had a very sort of accelerated experience on the night and a very accelerated recovery. And I went to see the counselor twice. The second time he says, you're more than fine. You're a strong man. You're going to be good. And I believed him, and he's right. Thank God. But, you know, yeah, of course, it throws you, but it takes you a while to... I mean, extraordinary things happen on that, and I don't know how much detail you've read about it, but one of the things that happened was, as we found our salvation in this roadside curio shop that was run off the back of this other drive-through safari park, where all these cooperatives have been making woven baskets and fantastic, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful original artifacts, carvings and... bowls made out of wires and recycled beads and just extraordinary objects. And it was run by about three or four women who were in this hut, and there were two or three men standing guard, because it was a roadside truck stop for the night, so people would come and, you know, get some Coca-Cola or whatever, or just relieve themselves and have a gossip. And that was the light on the horizon we ran to after we discovered that we were actually finally left alone, tied at the side of the road, and they'd gone. And when I was there, I had my shoelace was still tied around my right hand. I hadn't bothered untying it. And as I was telling the story, and these women were clucking and tutting and ticking and just and crying and shaking their head, saying, for shame, they steal from us too. They steal from the poor. It's so bad. We're so sorry this happened to you in our country. It was profoundly moving. And then to add to that, this hand came out, this black hand came out and untied the thing that had been used for my bondage and my white flesh, and the whole thing just snowballed in my head. Everything whites have done to that culture, and it just, the whole thing just suddenly smashed in. And it was a profoundly moving moment and I looked up into this man's face, having been scared by the men that were there initially, because could they be part of the gang? Because obviously everybody, and especially because we had our head to the ground and our eyes averted from their face, because they didn't want us to. If you identify them, you're a far more likely target for a killing. So you practice hard at not witnessing what's going on. And to be able to look into a black man's face in the night in South Africa and say thank you with tears running down your face as he takes away this final sort of token, I guess, of the night's the trauma, that was wonderful. And that was a huge part of the healing. And I wrote to him soon afterwards to explain that to him, and he understood exactly what I meant.
Well, yeah. I really appreciate you taking the time to be on our show, Benedict.
It's a pleasure.
It was really nice to talk to you.
Absolute pleasure. I hope that was all right.
Benedict Cumberbatch is the star of Sherlock. Both seasons of the show are available on DVD, and you can now stream them online via Netflix and Amazon Instant. You can also catch him as John Harrison in the upcoming film Star Trek Into Darkness, and as the voice of the dragon Smaug in the upcoming second installment of the Hobbit trilogy. It's Bullseye, I'm Jesse Thorne. Craig Finn is the frontman of the Brooklyn-based band The Hold Steady. They've been critically lauded for their albums over the past 8 years, in no small part due to Finn's lyrics. He's known for incredibly detailed, dense storytelling in his music. lyrics that weave together allusions to literary characters, religion, and popular culture. Finn released his first solo album, Clear Heart, Full Eyes, in 2012.
Feasting on the weakness of the women who are thinking you might be held to half the things you told them. The rackets that you left and the places that you slept, moving through the bars and slowly stalking.
As a kid in Minneapolis, Finn was hooked on the unpredictable music of the punk band The Replacements. He ran out to get their album Let It Be when he was in eighth grade and discovered what was soon to be his favorite song, I Will Dare.
1984, when the record came out, putting the needle down and hearing the first song, I Will Dare, is that, you know, shambling and romantic. That bass line, it sort of makes you feel cool when you hear it. I just feel like I get a little spring in my step, like walking down the street in a nice day sounds like, you know. I just really loved the sort of upbeatness of that first song. And The Replacements, to that point, you never knew it was a mixed bag. Positive. It felt like, you know, that things were possible. It felt like, it's almost like, you know, the skies are clearing. I'm sort of able to focus on the good things rather than the bad things. And Fingernails and Cigarettes Are a Lousy Dinner from that song is still like one of my favorite lyrics. And I love the lyric. I love, you know, if you will dare, I will dare. I mean, in the sense of it being a love song, I think it does take some bravery to fall in love and saying, like, if you will dare, I will dare. If you're ready to go here, I'll go here with you. I mean, the whole album stands out to me, just how drunken and obnoxious and belligerent they could be, but then just really vulnerable and sensitive too. Felt like there was both sides of it. It's almost like there was the Saturday night, you know, drinking and going out and trying to cause a ruckus, and then there's the Sunday morning sort of being hungover and reflective. Up until then, I didn't really think you could be in a rock band. I mean, rock bands were people like Axl Rose or Steven Tyler, you know. They didn't look like people I knew. They were rock stars. And The Replacements, yeah, there was a very human element to them, a very believable quality. And I grew up in Minneapolis, so they were a Minneapolis band. It was exciting to know that, you know, my favorite band was living in my town. So it kind of pointed to the idea that, you know, you're going to get by 13 or 14. Sometime you're going to be 23 and 24, and you're going to be able to do what you want. And if you want to be in a rock band, look cool and sit on a roof and smoke cigarettes, then that was possible. And there's optimism and hope in that. Still my favorite song.
Craig Finn on the song that changed his life, The Replacements' I Will Dare. Finn's solo album, Clear Heart, Full Eyes, is out now. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. Bullseye's on Twitter. Follow us at twitter.com/bullseye. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is Errol Morris, who might just be America's most gifted and acclaimed documentarian. His movies include The Fog of War, which won him an Oscar, The Thin Blue Line, which may have saved a man's life, and Gates of Heaven, which, according to the terms of a bet, forced Werner Herzog to eat a shoe live on stage.
And you shouldn't worry about it. We cooked it for 5 hours, but it's still more stiff than before. So I brought some pair of paltry scissors and some sharp knives.
Okay, I think we should let Brenner have the rest of his shoe in peace.
Is it getting better or getting worse?
Better.
I spoke with Errol Morris about the full breadth of his career. It was right around the time that he had completed a movie called Tabloid. The documentary is about a woman named Joyce McKinney. In the 70s, she was charged with abducting a Mormon missionary she had followed to England. Errol Morris and I spoke in 2011. I was thinking, as I was watching Tabloid, I was thinking about where it stood in these other films that you've made. And I was thinking about how committed you are to presenting people telling their stories in a way that's very interesting in the world of documentaries, I think, that you're rarely are, you know, trying to shoot events as they happen, but you're always trying to shoot a person talking about their version of their own experience.
Fair enough. I love first-person storytelling. Putting someone in front of a camera and getting them to tell me their story. Maybe I'm a kind of conceptual vacuum cleaner hoovering up this material, but it is essentially what I do. There are all kinds of interviews. Often I'm asked why I don't do 60 Minutes or Mike Wallace-type interviews, why I'm not an adversarial interviewer, why I don't back people up against the wall, ask the difficult, embarrassing question, try to trap them in contradictions. Why I don't do that, to me, the name of the game is to discovering something about other people, how they imagine themselves, how they describe their own experiences. So it's the opposite of Mike Wallace, if you like. It's creating a situation where people feel free to tell me stuff. It's preserving those ambiguities, those contradictions, not between the interviewer and the person being interviewed, but inherent in the story itself. And I am a kind of nutso journalist. I don't know how else to describe myself. You seek the truth. You have to, on some level.
Some of your films have been about going for the truth. I mean, I think, for example, The Thin Blue Line, which was about an actual real-life murder and convicted killers who were eventually released.
There was a guy sentenced to death for the murder of a Dallas police officer, and I investigated and found out he didn't do it. It was a terrible miscarriage of justice. But at the heart of the story, you want to answer a very simple kind of question. Did he do it? Was he the guy who shot the cop? Was it somebody else? And if it was somebody else, who was it? And I got the real killer to confess. This is at the end of my movie, The Thin Blue Line. Yes, there's a factual question
at the center of that.
Correct.
But on the other hand, like I was thinking of a lot of, you know, like your early movies, like Vernon, Florida, which I actually, I want to play a clip from Vernon, Florida. This is just one of the many unusual residents that you encountered in this town. He's talking about the way our minds work in his own amazing way.
You ever seen a man's brains? Oh, I've seen them. I take them up, scoop them up, put them in, do them up like brains. You're buying brains. But there's a bowl right here, and there's a bowl here, a bowl here, and a bowl there. Now, they're connected to the spine. The spine goes down the backbone. And if all four of these bowls or brains, if all four of them is functioning, you're not a one-track mind. You're a four-track mind. And you can... I see a lot of folks, they could type one letter, write me a letter and you a letter on the type machine and writing on one way with this hand and writing your letter with this hand and my letter with that.
But that is like a description. That film is about, I don't feel like it's about like an absolute, like trying to get to truth. And I wasn't even sure that Tabloid was about trying to get to truth. It felt like it was more about the truth at the center of it was a totally subjective personal truth on the part of the people who are telling the story, no matter how like bizarre and nutso they may be to some extent.
There's stories where you can get at the truth. Maybe you don't know it at first, but you persist, and eventually something shakes out of, in the case of The Thin Blue Line, over 2 years of investigating. Here, you're absolutely right, but we're limited. For example, Joyce McKinney came over to England with a gang of accomplices, Smith and Wesson handcuffs, a bottle of chloroform.
An actual bottle of chloroform.
An actual bottle of chloroform, a fake gun. Now, there's a question. Her love object, the man that she was totally obsessed with, the man she had to have, did she kidnap him? Well, clearly she was prepared to kidnap him, but did she really kidnap him?
She had the gear necessary.
She had the necessary gear, yes.
She had purchased a kidnapping
kit.
But
did she do it? And it's the limits of perhaps what we can know and what we can't know. There were three people present. One's dead. Can't interview him. The object of Joyce's obsessive love isn't going to speak to me. So what do? You have the outlines of a story that perhaps can't be entirely nailed down. You may never know. There's a mystery. This movie is filled with ongoing mysteries about motivations, about what really happened, about who these people really are. But one thing is clear, at least I hope it's clear, it's for real. It's proof that there is nothing stranger than reality. You could never do this in fiction. It's just too damn crazy. No one would believe it.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the documentarian Errol Morris. His films include The Fog of War, The Thin Blue Line, and most recently, Tabloid. His most recent book is nonfiction, titled A Wilderness of Error, The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. I want to ask you about something kind of goofy, which is, your career and your reputation have been built on your amazing documentary films. But a significant part of how you earn your living is directing commercials, like a lot of independent film directors. And you've created some really remarkable commercials. And there's one series that I remember when you opened a website and had some of your work and like a reel, a commercial reel on the website or something like that.
Still do.
I saw the clips and thought, oh, Errol Morris directed those. That's why they were like that. And that is this campaign for Miller High Life.
Yes.
I'm going to play the audio of one of these commercials called Olive Loaf.
Temptation tells you to have that olive loaf fresh from the pack. But you know a finger can break through the surface of stiff, cold meat, either popping out the olives or resulting in tears that can offend your sense of craftsmanship. Yes, better to let that lunch meat breathe. You know the reward for your patience. It's called living the high life.
I sometimes think my movies will be completely forgotten. No one will watch them. No one will know about them. But what will survive, ultimately, is my Miller High Life commercials. They're really, really good. The writing is extraordinary. I got to work. We call them the Jeffs, Jeff Kling, Jeff Salis, Jeff Williams. It was Errol and the Jeffs that created over 150 Miller High Life commercials. And we often wonder, how is it that they let us do this? And I think there's a simple answer. No one was really watching. No one really cared. And by the time they did care, we'd already done a lot of remarkable work. I'm very, very proud of them. And I tell Jeff Kling, who wrote Olive Loaf among many of these commercials, that he might have written the greatest line since Shakespeare, a commercial about Miller High Life and duct tape. The voiceover is,
"The High Life man knows that if the Pharaohs had duct tape, the Sphinx would still have a nose."
It's very, very good writing.
I like to listen to this public radio show out of Los Angeles, out of KCRW here in Los Angeles, called The Treatment, hosted by Elvis Mitchell. And he interviews a lot of filmmakers. And,
sure, I've been on it.
Yeah, it's great. It's a really wonderful program, and he's a brilliant interviewer. But I often think that they should have like a like the equivalent of a swear jar for when a feature filmmaker says, "I really think of myself as a storyteller." Because at this point, I think you get like 8 out of 10 of the guests on the show will have a part where they say, "Oh, I think of myself as a storyteller."
Yes.
But this, your new movie,
How about this? "I think of myself as a failed storyteller."
Your new movie, Tabloid, isn't just telling a story. Essentially, it's a story about storytelling.
Uh-oh. See, now I'm going to lose whatever audience I got from this show. It's gone now.
People who are like, "Oh, I remember those Miller High Life commercials. Those were great."
Now you've done it.
But it is. And I know that you have openly discussed subscribing to tabloids. And tabloids
are... Wait a minute. I openly subscribe to tabloids.
Yes.
I love tabloids.
Yes. And tabloids are about storytelling above all else. They're depending on the tabloid, they have varying degrees of grounding in the truth.
Simplified storytelling. Storytelling almost in the abstract. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the tabloid idea is, if you can't hook somebody in 4, 5, 6 words, game over. You got to work fast. You have to be succinct. You might call tabloid storytelling storytelling at ground zero. It's the essence of it. I do something a little bit different. I hope I'm not confessing to something that's going to get me into trouble. It's really as you described. I'm very much interested in how stories are constructed. I like tabloid stories, but I also like sneaking a peek behind the curtain of looking at how tabloid stories come to be, how they're manufactured. It's a way of giving us a perspective on narrative, on stories, on the relationship between... And this is one of my themes. It's certainly something that interests me, the relationship between stories and the truth. Do stories blind us to the truth? Do they help us see the truth? Do we really need stories in order to survive? I mean, what would life be without them? How would we ever navigate the chaos of reality without some way of taking all of these crazy experiences and details and making sense of them?
Errol Morris is a documentarian. His most recent film is Tabloid. His most recent book is titled A Wilderness of Error: The Trials of Jeffrey McDonald. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Every week we close the show with a recommendation from yours truly. It's The Outshot. I have a big old poster in my house. It's for Curtis Mayfield's record label, Kurtone, and it's basically just Curtis's face, beaming under a big floppy hat. When my son was born, I took the poster out of my office and I put it up next to his crib. He's still not old enough to understand who Mayfield was or why I'd choose a stranger's face to watch over him when he's sleeping. But there's something so kind in Curtis's eyes that I don't think it even matters, really. He can just bathe in that kindness. That's how I feel when I listen to People Get Ready, probably the greatest song that Mayfield ever wrote for his group The Impressions. Like I have a direct line to this man and his remarkable reservoir of kindness and trust and faith.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the divas humming. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
In 1965, when the success of the civil rights struggle was anything but assured and times were hard and dark, Mayfield sat down and wrote a pop song about faith. People Get Ready is a gospel song, really. But the gospel isn't exactly theological. It's about approaching even the darkest and most terrifying problems with an open heart. Facing down challenges with faith, not just in Jesus or God, but in love and decency. Faith that if you join others in doing what's right, the world will change around you. And here's the thing about the song. Here's the thing I want my son to know about meeting the world with an open heart. You don't need no ticket. You just get on board. That's my outshot.
Have pity on those whose chances grow thinner, for there's no hiding place against the kingdom's throne. So people can...
That's it for this week's Bullseye. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Julia Smith. Our senior producer, Nick White. Our intern, Lindsay Pavlis. Our interstitial music provided by Dan Wally. Look for us on Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud, where you can share your favorite segments with your friends. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, who believes that plants and gardening are for everyone. With over 25 years of developing, trialing, and testing some of the most recognized flowering shrubs and evergreens on the market, Proven Winners Color Choice makes it easy to transform dull yards into vibrant, colorful landscapes. Ready to spruce up your yard this spring? Proven Winners Color Choice created the Gardening Simplified Landscape Guide to help you get started with tried and true elements of good planting design. Identify the roles you want new plants to play in your outdoor space, like ground covers, climbers, or attracting pollinators. Then browse garden plans and see which layouts and plants can bring your vision to life. Proven Winners Color Choice shrubs are available in the distinctive white containers at garden centers nationwide. Learn more at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.